Hello and welcome to another episode of the Edge of Futures podcast. Still season three. We've not evolved into season four yet. And also, because it's just me and Ben, there's no new logo. We're four episodes in and there's no new logo. You can tell Dan's left us behind, can't you, Ben?
We're three episodes in, Steve.
No, we're not, Ben. We're four.
We are, Steve. We're three episodes
in. We're three. Right, yeah. Oh, we are. Because, yeah, I'm getting mixed up with it. I'm terrible. We've done some disjointed recordings of different ones that are going, I'm terrible. Why did anybody think it was a good idea allowing me on a podcast? Has nobody ever seen me present before? I've just been told off for saying I'm off to park or I'm off to do something because I don't put that in anywhere. But yeah, how's your week been, Ben? How's it been?
Stephen, it has been wonderful. I've had a good day today. I've been working with a group of students and staff at a college who are, interestingly, starting their own student-led podcast and wanting to do some content out into the world about that's relevant for students. So they said that there's podcasts that are out there that are great for adults. There seems to be some great stuff for on TikTok and whatever else, but they want something that's like kind of snippet, educational, real life stuff. So I've been working with them. So that's been a bit of a highlight this week, which has been fun. And I'm still reading In the Moment by Neil Malarkey. I've nearly finished that. I think a few of you who are listening will have read the same. Neil was at the Google Champions Symposium in Dublin and got hold of his book. And there's just so much in it. And I tell you why I love it the most is because he's a little bit like me in the sense that I don't mean to liken myself to somebody who's like a comedy superstar. I mean, I feel like one of those people who goes from one random thought to another random thought, and there is a thread, but it just goes off in different directions. And he does improvisation, improv comedy. So, I'm finding a little bit of a synergy with it. What about you, bud?
It's been a good one. It's been a good one. We are in our real life preparing for bet. When it goes out, with bets already gone. We're in that cat, is the cat alive in the box again situation, Ben, that we talked about on the last podcast or the podcast in the future and the next podcast. I don't know which podcast we're talking about. All preparing for that. Tomorrow, I'm doing a full day of learning. I'm really excited. I'm attending an AI for Future Leaders in Education conference at Liverpool. John Moore's a good friend of the podcast of mine.
Can you even spell AI?
I can. IA, is it? I don't know.
Sorry.
There's not too many vowels. As a dyslexic, I'm taking offence, Ben.
Sorry.
It's fine, mate. It's cool. I'm a terrible speller, and I'm glad that you are there to reread all of the emails I send out. So Aftab Hussain's going to be presenting. Pete Atherton, who wrote the book that we had on the podcast many, many moons ago, will be there. Rose Looking. I'm looking forward to the event and just been in that space. Nice. Doing a lot of stuff around AI, and it's a really hot topic. So I'm just interested in what those spaces are doing and where it sits.
And interesting, that, Steve Aftab was our first ever winner of Futures of the Year, wasn't it?
It was.
Back in 2019.
He's a good guy of education, is Aftab. Some brilliant stuff that gets unsung often, and it was great to celebrate the work that he's doing and his team over at Bolton College. And then the rest of the week in real life, I'm taking the kids to London for it's 100 years of Disney. It's my wife's birthday, or it's my wife's birthday this week, and my boy's birthday a couple of weeks ago. So we're all going down to the exhibit, and we're going to go to the Sea Life Centre and the Natural History and all of those kind of things. And just
whoop, whoop.
Breathe away from work and just really fill the cup up and do really what's important in life, which is I love what I do and I love the podcast and everything that I'm involved in. But really, it's about the kids and the family, isn't it, when we really start to unpick it. But I'm just conscious of last time it was about 8 minutes before we even brought our guest in. and at some point, this person is very humble and brings a real air of humility. I met this person quite a few years ago when I was still in education, and I was probably more nervous than I should have been based on now the person I know, because this person is just really honest, and based on some of the work that this person has done, some people would let it go to their head, I'll be honest, and I've been excited. Ben keeps winding me up saying he gets 99 out of 100 podcast guests on, and I pull one big one out, and we've been excited for this one for a long, long time, haven't we? So I suppose without further ado, should we bring Liz in. How are we doing, Liz?
I'm great. Yeah, nice to be with you both.
Yeah. So for those people, I don't think they're Edinburgh, but we were looking at a listenership, and 70% of our listeners are split between the UK and the US. Mm-hmm. But obviously, we've got percentages and listenership literally globally on all seven continents. I don't think six. I don't think we're Antarctica yet.
I'm going to go to Antarctica and just listen to it just to make a point, I think.
But for those people who don't know your work, do you want to kind of just do a bit of an introduction to yourself and the journey that you've been on, Liz?
Sure, yeah, lovely. Yeah, well, we were laughing, weren't we? Because we're all Northerners, and I think we were trying to outdo each other on who was more common, but... I think you might have had a false perception of how posh I might be, but there we go. Yeah, my background is that I was brought up in the Lake District. And basically, I just can't really kind of fathom how I kind of got here, to be honest, because it's been quite a journey. I studied English at Hull, and then I did actually spend some time in a classroom in Hull, which was quite tough because really impoverished city. And then I ended up working in academic publishing. So I'd always had this inclination towards education and helping people improve. And I did a master's, and I got a job down in Routledge, which was a kind of sort of social science, really known for its social science publishing, which was amazing. It was a bit like graduating and going to do another degree course. It was really, really fun and really, really amazing. Although it was, I guess, quite eye-opening from a kind of background perspective, because I kind of got to work with people that I had never really met before. And I remember my opening lunch when I joined the team down there was in a Japanese restaurant, which was absolutely terrifying. I just really did not know like what to do, you know. It was just kind of out with my experience. And I suppose, you know, that's sort of there's obviously been something in me that's quite driven, because I kind of went on to do pretty well. I was like managing people at around 22 or something ridiculous. And then went on to work at Pearson, which people probably know, you know, major educational publisher working in the K-12 and the higher ed space. And then always like with a bit of a lens on doing something new. So I was always in big companies, but I was always doing innovative things, starting new things up. So in Pearson, I ended up launching this program called Custom Publishing, which was the kind of first offering in Europe for the ability to kind of create bespoke content options, be they digital or in print. So lecturers, it was for higher ed, got what they really, really wanted rather than, you know, what the textbook gave them. And then I spent some time, this is long, you'll have to shut me off if I, you
know, no, keep going. This is the journey's so important. Keep going, keep going.
I mean, when do you get to talk about yourself for an hour?
This is your life. This is where we get the red book out. This is where we get the red book out.
Exactly. And then I'd kind of done that job running this team for, I don't know, maybe 6 or 7 years or something. And I got a bit itchy feet. And I remember it was a toss up between going to Sweden or going to Dubai and to do a different kind of role. And I ended up going to the Middle East. Not because I was kind of attracted to the glitz and the glam and the kind of moneyed impression you get of the region, but more because in that part of the world, especially at that time, and it's still the same, there was this real drive to kind of change education systems. And there was an openness at the ministerial level to work with vendors and suppliers to help them achieve their goals. And that was quite unusual, because in the West, you know, the politicians play a certain role in education systems. It's variable, the impact they can have, sometimes strong, sometimes low. But in that part of the world, it's a much more autocratic and top-down driven system. So it was a really fantastic experience, a bit scary at times. I have some stories about things I experienced, like traveling to Nigeria, and I used to go to Saudi all the time. And mainly, and this is relevant because I think it links to where I'm at now, I ended up doing most work in professional development for teachers and leaders across that region. And we won some really large bids in different countries there that kind of had the goal of, you know, really changing how education looked and felt. And I think that was what I was really passionate about. And it was my first foray into K-12. So I kind of learned a lot about that and how schools work. And then I ended up getting the job at Google. Oh my God, that was a day. That was a moment. And I came back, brought the family back to London and back into the old home. And, you know, I think I arrived and there were three of us. There was they were all based in Ireland, and then had this amazing journey over 8 years where, you know, it's just a fantastic role, really, because it was both very commercial. So it was all about building partnerships and channels. I'd never done that work before, dealing with device manufacturers. Again, had no knowledge of that whatsoever. So all the kind of hard stuff, you know. And then equally hard, actually, and equally a growth opportunity for me was around really building a personal profile, I guess, and being out there in the education sector and sharing Google's vision for education and learning and doing some crazy things at BET. That I remember my first speaking opportunity, I was sandwiched between Bob Geldof and the Secretary of State for Education. I was like, okay, I've got this. I can do this. This is kind. This is fine.
That sounds like a really strange new Christmas song. New Band-Aid between Bob Geldof, Liz Sprott, and the Education Secretary would be a plan on it.
Maybe one of those names doesn't fit so well. It was hilarious, but it worked. And actually, in that, I remember being really honest about my background and sharing a lot about, you know, growing up in the Lake District and stuff, and that journey. And then I did a couple of years at Lego and moved out of. I'd always been in sort of go to market and selling, and I really wanted an opportunity to look more at learning outcomes. I mean, the Dubai time was interesting because it was more about crafting and developing programs, but I was the front of initiatives into a client. And so I did a span of time there. And then, frankly, I had some health issues, and it kind of made me reevaluate really what it was all about and what I wanted to do and how I wanted to spend the rest of the time on the planet. And also what I'd like really got my energy from through those years. And hence now sort of reinventing my life and LizSproteCoaching.com. There you go. Is that a plug? That's what it is.
We'll put this into the show notes 100%. And we're definitely going to spend an awful amount of time talking about, because ultimately I think it really will impact education. I know that you're doing some work, and we'll discuss some of the work that you're doing with deputies through charities, and then potentially some of the work that you're going to be leading into.
Yeah.
But also we have covered coaching. I think coaching, Ben, you provide coaching and I've had coaching. I try and provide coaching where possible. I think we're all ultimately, it's just if you're not passionate about helping people, then it doesn't add value to it. It's definitely not something you should be doing, because people would just be like, it's like teaching. You just wouldn't do it if you weren't passionate about it, would you?
Yeah, exactly.
So we'll just
jump on that as well. I think the conversation around coaching is really interesting, in that where I think it really ties around nicely is that a lot of people are moving in their thinking that the educator, the role of an educator, is absolutely moving into that style of coaching. And some people don't like the word facilitation, but I still stick with it right now, because I'm not sure we've got a better option. But you have experienced a classroom, you've experienced the boardroom, and now you're experiencing your living room or wherever else you are in terms of a coaching room. Yeah. And I suppose there's probably stories and links from what you got from the classroom, what you got in the boardroom, and then what you've ended up taking into that coaching room.
Definitely. I'm kind of struck by this idea of curiosity, I guess, because my career has had like a lot of shifts and changes within it. And genuinely, when I got that role at Google, I had quite a solid sort of background in commercial education. I was a commercial leader. I understood how to manage teams and things. There was an awful lot to learn. And I think one of the things I kind of gained from that is that it was all right not to know. And I think that actually there's a really strong parallel with coaching around, you know, you just have to be really, really curious about what's going on for the client, what else is at stake for them. It's not always what you see. It's not always what they say. It's a whole combination of things that can really help you discover what might be going on for people. And in that same way, that curiosity, like knowing that I didn't know everything, wasn't something that really, you know, caused a problem for me. I was quite comfortable with that, because if I was curious with the people in front of me and I could develop the rapport and understand what their goals and needs and what was at stake for them, then it helped me succeed commercially as well. So I think that that curiosity element has definitely helped me. And then those wonderful moments, right? Like we've all had them, like when we're leading teams, you know, I think I wouldn't be blowing my own trumpet when I shared with you that at Google, the team that I was managing, they used to have this expression that was, which was that you'd been Liz'd. And it basically meant that we'd had a conversation where largely something that you already knew they wanted to do, they would come out with a renewed passion for it and they'd really follow it through and they'd be committed to making a change. And that was, you know, that was also a really fascinating team to manage, because when I joined, they're super, you know, the whole Google culture, right? Really bright, way, way younger than me, not authoritarian culture. Like I'd come from a, you know, fairly top-down culture at Pearson. You know, it was, you pretty much knew where power rested in an organization like that. And so, you know, there was an absolute passion in those people. Once I'd kind of established myself, because that took a bit of time, like gain their respect, that they wanted to learn. And so that kind of culture of like constantly growing and wanting feedback and being very much available for that and demanding it almost, was also a really great experience in terms of like now landing here, because I kind of really learned, you know, how to do that well in a way that was really, really constructive. How did you find coaching, Ben? Did you like it?
I enjoy it. I think the thing I enjoy about it is that I don't do it all the time. And that sounds really strange, because as you probably heard in that intro, but the benefit I have and I'd like to think I bring to organizations is that I can hold lots of things in tension and then be able to dive into one thing. If I do one thing and only do one thing, I get bored really easily and also get restless. That's just probably just my neurodivergence or whatever else we want to call it. I think it sits really nicely for me to be able to move away from being a mentor or being somebody who taught people, educated, this is what you need to do. What I have really learned from it in the opportunities I've had, which would be on a much smaller scale than what you're doing, but that ability to be able to help that other person find what they're trying to do, as opposed to like you were just saying about that being Liz'd in the places you worked. Like I don't want, and I find it difficult when you've got, and you're probably the same, got a million ways that you think you could tell them what to do, but then you want to have to try and get them to get to that and work it out themselves. So that's probably how I find it. But then the hardest bit for me is that's why I always have a one of these old school, old logo, Edgy Futurist logo, little squashy ball, where I just like, I'm playing with this all the time, throwing it at a wall, people, just because that stops me from answering my own questions.
Nice. Good technique. Nice.
So just on that, I think the core to it is everybody's been through education. I think education is an interesting one because everybody's been through it generally, especially in England, and everybody has an opinion of it based on their experience. But I think I've not come across somebody that disagrees with the fact that the best teachers that we know, that we've seen, have the ability to coach and nurture individuals. And I think that's a bit where, as much as teachers want to be classed as teachers, I think it's just a name on the tin. Call it unicorn stardust if you want, but ultimately it's about what we're trying to achieve from. And I think my best teachers were those that had the ability to really nurture my passions and bring me along regardless of where I saw myself and identifying something in me that I probably didn't see myself. Coaching is really, really linked to it. And so is leadership. We've all done leadership roles, we've all done teaching roles, even if it's for a short period of time. And the link between them is managing is different, but I think leading is finding that ability to to really develop people to solve their own problems. I don't know if anybody's come across him as a person to have a conversation with on this call, and maybe our listeners. Colin Booth at Luminate Education Group. He was at Newcastle. He was at Barnsley. When I first met him, he knows what I'm going to say, is he was called the Butcher of Barnsley. He basically, everybody at Luminate Education Group, like, he's going to come in, he's going to get rid of this, he's going to cut this. And I found and I came across a very different individual over the time that I got to know him and as I moved into different leadership roles. His whole thing was, I was born on the Battle of Trafalgar Day, and my whole vision of leadership is each ship will be able to lead themselves and be able to be self-sufficient, because in the Battle of Trafalgar, if it come a direction comes from one person, if that person is inactive or can't, how does anyone solve their own problems and resolve them?
Yeah.
And that's the way I see teaching and learning. I think there's a massive link between them. And I'd probably already known it, but Colin Booth as a leader really helped me develop that from one 30-minute talk, and I was like, this guy's a genius. He isn't, and he's so strong in his passion, clearly. But have you got any experiences, without giving the game away and anything else, in regards to whether that's in your leadership role, any real talent that you had a passion for nurturing, or anything in your recent past of coaching that really recollects and comes back to, this is experience and this is a approach that I took and this is the impact it had on any individual?
Well, I'd definitely say, so as I was qualifying, I did a lot of coaching across a really disparate group of people. So I actually used, there's a Slack site for ex-Googlers, and I started off because I fully qualified in August, but I was doing loads and loads of coaching at the beginning of the year. And it was amazing because I got like loads of people from really varied different types of company, like McKinsey, Apple, a startup called Truro, a startup in the employee resourcing space. And then alongside that, I was coaching for a charity called Inspiration for All. It was set up by Sarah Caton and a colleague of hers. And that charity is dedicated to deputy heads and heads in impoverished parts of, I think it's the UK, it might be London only, to be fair, but I think it's the UK. And what struck me from that was, well, A, just the enormity of the leadership challenge that exists as a school leader. So I could kind of, you know, when you're coaching, you have variability in the client bringing their challenges to you. So you have some people that come and they really are very self-aware. They know what the problem is. And every week you'll be boom, boom, boom. And they're really on it. And then there's others where you have to find techniques to stimulate their thinking and get them to reflect. But without mentioning names, and it's fine, actually, because I've done a group of these folks through that charity. You could kind of almost package up all my clients' problems, and then it kind of got close to what this deputy head was experiencing. So it was super, super fascinating. And it's just kind of, you know, I've always been really, I think my humility in part when I was in those roles was the acknowledgement that the real work is done in the classroom. It was never being done in the jobs that I had. So I was very, very conscious of that. And with one of the individuals that I was working with there, one of the things that was really fascinating was what happens when your values are compromised. So, you know, so much of our success, and again, I think we all know, like, great schools are led by great leaders. And we now have, different leadership models in the school systems. We have different philosophies and approaches across MATS about how they should be run. And I had one client come forward who was really processing his place within that world, you know, what did that really look like? And I think, you know, at a time when loads of people are leaving the teaching profession, and obviously when our values get compromised, that's a real, you know, it's a real thing to kind of come to terms with. Do we want to stay in the organization we're in? We want to move on? Does it even like affect us more deeply than just the position we're in? Does it affect how we feel about ourselves and our confidence and happiness levels? The story for one of the people that I coached was actually moving on to appreciate their own potential through the work we did together. And that person actually went on to become a head teacher. He didn't stay where he was, but from meeting him in quite a kind of compromised position and not really sure what he was gaining from the environment he was in, he went on to find his kind of flow, I guess, and what he really wanted to do. So I've got to say, of all the people I've coached, because I've helped people be better at time management, and I've helped people think about their strategy at the senior leadership team level or the organizational design of their company. But seeing someone, you know, go from maybe not the happiest place into realizing their dream and their ambition, that was super. It was really, really brilliant. It was really great. Yeah.
I was struggling to find the unmute button then, Steve, because I was. I think I love hearing that, and I think what I honed in on what you were saying there is about how do you, as a human, deal with whatever that is, whether you're in business, whether you're in education, whether you're in life. What do you do when your values are either it's about. I'll come back out. How do you know what your values are? Yeah. So how do you determine what your values are and what's important to you? How do you deal with ensuring that other people understand your values? And then what happens when those values are compromised? And then the process that sits through that. Interestingly, when I first went self-employed, which is I don't know how long ago, but it's a while. I remember hearing somebody say you need to make sure you decide what you're going to stand for and what you're going to be, not just what you're going to do, but the values you're going to go for. And I shared these with Steve, and he probably won't remember I said this. Shared them with Steve, and I put one of the things was I want to do fun, I want to do innovation, I want to do things around that are going to put, it's going to push the needle forward for education primarily. I want to have things that have an impact. Da, da, da. And then he just said to me, "When you forgot family." Because your number one value is family, and I went, yeah, you're right, and because I kind of assumed that, I hadn't been articulate in what I was saying, and then interestingly, and Steve again doesn't know this story, that there was an opportunity to take some work that was going to be out of the UK, and it would have meant that I could have commuted back at weekends and whatever else, but there'd be a good chunk of time where I wouldn't be in the UK. And I didn't even entertain it because my value that I'd agreed was family. That wasn't saying that people who work away are, but for me, having been working in education and done all the crazy hours that I'd done, I played silly at that. So I didn't want to make, so it became a value. So it wasn't that my values had been violated or compromised, but I couldn't allow myself to be compromised in that situation. And it's interesting to hear you talk about that. In terms of like, from your perspective then, how do you help people come through that when either they can't articulate the values or perhaps... That process of compromise.
Yeah. So what I normally do, well, anyway, when you sort of start out with me, we kind of have like a get to know. So we do like a 30 minutes on who you are. And then we do a scoping session, which really helps to be very precise about what it is they want to achieve through the coaching and really like help them think about how do they know whether they've made progress. And it was all like you said earlier, it's the agencies with them. Like, what do they want to get out of it? Not what I might see. And that's challenging to learn how to do that, especially when you've led teams and you can sort of see things yourself. But the other thing that I tend to do at the beginning is I'll do 16 personalities, which is an MBTI-based personality assessment, and then a strengths-based assessment, just to kind of kickstart a bit of reflection for them about who they are. Now, I'll be honest, I don't always do like a thorough deep dive on it, because sometimes people show up and they're just on it. They just know, right? They just know what's on their mind and they just want to get straight in. And actually, funnily enough, I've just taken on the next new deputy head. And same again, like he's just straight on with the challenge there. But that's quite a useful tool just to sit back and reflect. And the 16 personalities particularly, it'll help you say, well, you know, this is a strength that you have, but how does it show up in a way that serves you? And then how does it show up in a way that maybe is a detriment to you? And I think what I've learned from my own experience is that the things that are what make you super, super successful can also be the things that detract from other parts of yourself. And it's really about trying to achieve that kind of balance, as you say, right? Like you gave that really good example of having to choose between the value in your family and probably money and all the other things that had gone along with that really amazing job. So that piece of work really helps people have a bit better understanding of what's going on. And then as you're going through the coaching process and you're working with people over time, you tend to see these patterns. And that's actually a super helpful thing for the client when you see something happening again and again. It might be about a value or a behavior. And because you're there observing and you're just really listening, right, and being curious, you can help them see when something's showing up repeatedly. But on the kind of like, how do you deal with when your values are compromised? I mean, again, it's within the client's scope to decide how they process that. But oftentimes we get triggered in ways that aren't very helpful. You know, like we can if we're very if we're somebody who's very opinionated or very believes in rules or is very moralistic in a good way, you know, like, again, a real strength. I believe things should be done fairly, right? That's a really good example. That is a great quality. I believe things should be done fairly. But then we're in systems that are political, they're charged with different dynamics, and oftentimes they're not. So you can either like get angry about it, you can get sad about it, you can get all kinds of different kind of emotions to it. But one of the things I try to kind of help people be is curious about it. So what's going on? Why is that dynamic happening? Try and abstract oneself a little bit from being right in the thick of it and take a step back and kind of try and appreciate what's going on. Because again, another quality that can sometimes come up in that scenario is that you begin to think that it's something intrinsically to do with you. There might be something wrong with you, when for the most part, it's often something that's happening, oftentimes out with your control. So kind of help people get a bit of distance between what's happening for them, get the emotional charge out of it so they can observe it and think about it rationally. And that gives you the space to decide, well, can I succeed here? Is it the right place? Or am I better served by doing something different? And that kind of works. And the other thing to sort of lead into that, which I'm very passionate about, is a lot of coaching focuses on the what, right? Like, well, what should I do? And many times you have clients and they'll be like, well, what should I do, Liz? And gosh, it's hard, right, to sort of pull back and not say, well, you know, what you should do is you should do this. One of the things that I'm really passionate about and integrating more into my practice is really that kind of focus on who you are and why, what makes you behave and work in a certain way, and to help give you that understanding of yourself. Because when you think about coaching engagements, if I help somebody make a decision about what to do, of course, that has a meaningful impact. Absolutely, it does. But if I help someone understand who they are and why they behave in a certain way, then the longevity of that impact is far, far longer than the single decision they might make about whether or not somebody should be on their SLT or not. So I get, and obviously as a coach, you have to lean into what the client wants, but that's where I get super passionate, is like, can I help people see things differently, learn about themselves, and maybe react in a better way that serves them? And one of the things I do is a session on imposter syndrome, which I found really, really powerful, because most of the time our sense of imposter syndrome comes intrinsic to who we are as a person, and it's often linked to something that's happened to us in the past. And again, you can help reframe people's perspectives on that with the right kind of techniques and tools, which is nice.
Yeah, and I think just touching on what you talked about of your whole approach and what you're trying to achieve when you're doing the coaching, of if you get them to fix one problem or help them fix one problem, then the fix one problem potentially does have an impact on them and their organization. But I think if you get them to think about the approach of why and why those decisions are made, so it leads on to making decisions like that, and with that thought process each time, then ultimately I think it's a good step into the whole approach of, it's not, coaching is just not what, but about that one person. It's about the impact it has across them, their teams, the people that maybe lead them, or the people that they lead, the people around them, colleagues, the organisation they work in, ultimately their students if it's an education. And I think potentially that could be a blocker, like much training into education. When you talk about aligning an investment or a cost in education, like many public sector bodies, it's attached to one individual. So if a head comes and says, right, Liz, want some training, and you say, yeah, it's this, the school often, or even any within the organisation, would say that cost is attributed to that one person. I think there has to be a realisation and an honesty of, if the coach is doing the role effectively and you get the right coach in, it changes the whole organisation potentially, because that person becomes a better coach and a better person to the people around them and support, because they understand why they're making the decisions and they do that on that. But we'll go back to the beliefs and values bit. But do you think that that's one way that we can change education's approach to coaching, that see it as a value across an organisation rather than an individual, is, I suppose, what I'm trying to get at?
A couple of things come up for me when you say that, which is brilliant. Appreciate you bringing that up, because there's both what the coaching looks like for the individual, which, again, I'm a really firm believer in systemic coaching, which focuses on not just the individual that you see, but takes account of the system that they're within and helps them think about their place within that system and why the system operates in the way that it does. So you know, not only have you got the potential, as you're saying rightly, to change their system, overusing the word, but their organization that they're part of, right? Because they show up differently and they bring different approaches and techniques, but it also helps them be more conscious of what's happening in the system more broadly and like what's working about that and what might not be. But the other idea, which I think could gain real traction and be more scalable, is group coaching. So one of the things I think would work phenomenally well, because the role of a head teacher or deputy head is, you know, these are isolated roles that, you know, you are very much the focus of that entire school. It's a really tough job. And I'm sure there are people out there doing that. So I don't want to assume that none of it happens. And I know from with my own coaching, single coaching with the deputy heads and heads, there's definitely a mentoring model that exists. I hear very informally that that's happening a lot. But you could imagine, you know, a group coaching model and perhaps some kind of scaled learn coaching skills and then scale that through the system. And actually lots of companies do that. And there's this term like coaching everywhere, which is where, you know, instead of a coach coming in or multiple coaches coming in and coaching individuals based on, you know, who they like to work with kind of thing, they will do a train the trainer model and they'll build a kind of coaching philosophy throughout the organization. Which, you know, I think at Google, we were sort of doing that. You know, there was a really strong emphasis on a feedback culture and we were trained on how to deliver that feedback in the way that, you know, as you said, drove autonomous decision making and wasn't telling and was helping the person see it their own way. But we didn't call it that at the time. So, yeah, I could really imagine it being incredibly powerful to have coaching circles across deputy heads and heads, or trust maybe coalescing their training and development in a model like that. And I'd feel really confident that would have a really big impact on how, you know, longevity, sticking with it, growing as a leader, all of those things I think would be really, really helped through that.
I think it'd be transformative in education, I think. And like you said, we're starting to see pockets of this. I'm chair of governors at a primary school and the head teacher there is a new head. And as part of their new to headship program, obviously they have training and NPQH and in the UK and similar across the world. But he has a experienced head who's his mentor and he has informal a group coaching from advisors. And this, I think it's very interesting that when we have conversation, I don't think he'll mind me saying this. In fact, It's tough luck, even if he does mind. We've been really serious all the way through this conversation. I'm very proud of myself.
Yeah, I know. I'm reflecting on the one that I heard from John. I'm like, there's probably not enough humour in here. But
no, I think the conversation that I found with this head was that everybody has a way of doing things, don't they? And they're like, well, with finance, this is what you should do. With staff welfare, this is what you should do. With disciplinary, this is what you should do. With HR, with estates, all the things that go with it. Yeah. And everything is well-intentioned. And I look at this a lot of the time. A lot of it's well-intentioned and they want to help, but it's like, but these clothes don't fit me. This doesn't fit me. And I'm trying to put on Saul's armor when actually I've got to use a different model. And I think from the work in education to help people come to this is the challenge they're working on. And one of the things that I think it relates really well to is both me and Steve were part of the Google Certified Innovator Program, which we always talk about. And then I know that they've relaunched it again for 2024. And one of the things that we talk about in that is we were told we had to come up with or talk about a problem in education, and then rather than and then use design thinking obviously to try and come up with some solutions, which I know is part of the culture at Google, isn't it? But that principle of rather than coming with this is what I could do, it's more like how might we develop this or deal with this or solve this problem. And I think that approach tied with some clever coaching with great questioning and prodding in the right direction, and that could be revolutionary for not just for teachers and leaders in education, but I actually think that is the same for students too, because that's because that innate curiosity that you were talking about earlier. Students have got interests. Why can we not somehow make our curriculum developed around a how might we model that they're then exploring and curious about?
And it's fascinating because I'd really encourage, like you're describing, a scenario where you're bringing in an approach maybe that wasn't centered in education. And I think that's something for the sector to be really open to, because a number of times I've heard, well, only another head could coach another head, because only another head knows what it's like to be a head. And then you're getting into that dangerous ground of where, you know, the person being coached is at risk of being advised into or strongly encouraged, and the autonomy that you're trying to develop. Because actually the other thing about coaching that's kind of weird is the whole job of it is to make yourself redundant, because you want to give that person the techniques and tools so they don't need you. And a lot of coaches end up in a scenario where they're kind of kept on and on and on because they're really advising and they're a crutch to the person that's leading. So surely there are amazing heads that can coach other heads, but it's a really great idea to both refresh on what the coaching methodology looks like. You know, you do learn how to do it. It draws on, you know, psychology and different interdisciplinary approaches to learn how to actually be good at it, and mix it up a bit, use different kind of coach stakeholders so that you kind of get a different angle on how to achieve growth, I guess.
We're not quite at the quick fire questions yet, so we don't have to be as quick fire, but I think the last thing that I definitely want to ask is, it doesn't have to be a coach, but to where you are now, do you have people that you can say their name or people that you can just talk about the experience of the best coaches that you've had, or some of the people that have been most influential to get you into the roles that you've done, the person you are, it doesn't have to be work-wise, or into the coaching role that you're actually now finding your feet in and doing really, really well in?
Yeah. I gotta say, I don't know how many of you remember Ross. Did you guys know Ross Mahon? Maybe you didn't. He was a team member on my team, and he passed away. And I think it was a really, really difficult period anyway. And I remember when I first met him, he was doing a speech to, it was probably, I remember, it was the Certified Innovator Group in the very first months that I joined Google. And he was doing a talk about, and I had to write this down because I can't really pronounce this guy's name. That's Mihai Csikszentmihalyi. talking about flow. And yeah, that sticks with me actually, because he was in his flow. Ross was in his flow and he loved doing this kind of work. And I, yeah, I'll always kind of remember that moment. And I remember the philosophy of the guy that he was talking about and how powerful that was. I'd not heard of this guy. It was really impressive. So that sticks with me. And obviously, you know, leading through that period obviously was a really, really tough thing to go through. And then, yeah, like life, it's the intersection of life, isn't it? And which for a long time, I think I hadn't really appreciated. I'd been very driven. I kind of always looking for the next thing, like always, you know, striving for whatever would take me further. And then life interjects. So a few things that that kind of helped me were practical things. Like when I realized I wanted to do something different, I read a load of books. I've got one of them here, Designing Your Life. So like, how could I change my life to make it what I wanted to be? And then when I did my course, I got a bit, I'm a bit serious, aren't I, really? I think you can tell I'm a bit serious. So I got quite, I did it at Henley and it's quite academic. So I got quite into the psychology behind coaching. And to that point about, you know, how do you deal with the whole person? I'm really fascinated by this particular kind of therapy called internal family system therapy, which I'm not even going to try and tell you what that is here because you'll think I'm either a nutcase or I won't do it justice. But it's a really powerful technique for to think about ourselves and how we function and how we make decisions. So I could, there's loads of things, there's loads and loads, but I tend not to be so much into the kind of five steps to do X. That kind of doesn't like get me going, you know, some of those things, just not so much. Yeah,
yeah, I definitely hear that, and I also hear that because I also think that becomes very formulaic and forgets the idea of that squiggly middle bit, that bit of it's never a straight line, is it? So,
yeah.
I think Steve, I think we are at that quick fire round, aren't we?
Should we go there?
Yeah. So. I feel like I'm going to start sounding like Stephen Bartlett.
Remember, there's only three.
Yeah.
Do I have to answer really, really quickly?
No. We just thought.
Ben's clearly asking in a quick fire way. It's taken 15 minutes to ask the question that should have been 15 seconds. At least you get 5 seconds from
that. I'll tell you what it is. I'm thinking to myself, I've started to sound like Stephen Bartlett. We always ask the guest a question. No. This is the question that we're going to ask. So the first one is the future of exams, because obviously online, traditional, scrapped. What do you think?
Just different. Just completely different. Yeah. I mean, like the nirvana, isn't it? Like, actually, I know you're going to ask me another question. I'm going to end up answering it. But assessment is the problem and not the opportunity. That's, in my opinion, like to all the change we want to see, until we fix that. Yeah.
So, in Liz's words, I'll speak for her. She said scrapped, but no. That was the most political.
I haven't even got a PR person like on my back telling me what to say and not to say.
I know this is quickfire, but me and Liz were having a conversation like a pre. Let's talk about. And I'm gonna maybe embarrass you. I probably shouldn't say this, Liz, but you were saying. You invite me on the podcast. I don't think I'm really the right fit and I'd really have anything to say. And I was like, I'm not sure you really know. Oh, well, this is, I'm going to have a massive appetite for it. But then we talked about my experience of recently presenting at Google or a year ago at the Google Partner Forum. And I'm sure if any Google are listening, hi, Google. But yeah, we talked about the fact that I was doing a bit of a 5-minute presentation around a partner forum, and it took me 3 days through marketing, lawyers, and through the marketing meetings to maybe plan this. And I was like, they kept talking about these tech track talks, and I kept saying, what even is that? And it's basically, you have to write a script. And I was like, I'm not going to do that. And they made me. And then I was sharing the experience of when I got up on stage, I read the room, and it had been very scripted throughout the day. And I took a deep breath and I went off script, and the panic that I saw behind the scenes, and apologies to those Google marketing people and the lawyers that work for Google, the fear. But I think I did all right. Anybody who's seen me present, I'm not the best, but I tell a bit of a story and I'm honest. And Google, and they came to me and then said, we panicked, but it did work. So, yeah, I think Liz has been PR'd within an inch of her life, probably working at that level of Google.
I'm not sure it was the same in my days. I might have forgotten that time when I like got 400 people at the backstage to do a mass meditation, and they were like, "Yeah, okay, Liz, you think you can do it? Go for it." I was like, "Yeah, great." It was very weird. It was really good fun.
Back to quickfire. Are you ready? Yeah. Key skill for students in 2020. 2040, what do you think it would be?
Yeah, I don't know. You never got to choose one, isn't it? Resilience, self-awareness. I don't know.
Oh, I'm so surprised. Can I jump in? I thought you were going to say curiosity.
Oh, yeah, maybe. I should have said that.
But all key, all key. Yeah, resilience. I think there's a challenge in people. Joe, the fear of... Sorry, these are not quick fire. Anybody's listening, well, I apologise. We've ruined this quick fire section, but I'm loving this chat, so we'll carry on. I was attending a war of retention and a war of recruitment event for Leeds University Business School, part of a qualification I've been doing, and I go back to that and a regular part of that community. And we were talking about there's a massive fear of failure, and when they get to the university, this lecturer was talking to us about obviously employment and everything else when it comes to us and taking graduates on, but also what they're seeing now in education at the university level, where they're getting people coming to them and going, can I just talk to you about my assignment in the first year? And they're going, yeah, well done. Going, and they burst out crying. They go, I got 60. And the person has to say to him, no, that's really, really good. And they're going, but I didn't get 100.
Yeah.
And I think we've created, going back to your first point, assessment, going back to what we've created, we've not created resilience. We've created a real fear of failure in young people because of the way that it is. But anyway, go back to quickfire, Ben. Save me from this moment.
To be honest, we might edit that bit out. Sorry.
Oh, I don't think you did that.
No, we don't. Unless it's really bad.
Okay.
No, just joking. Sorry, Steve. The final quick fire question, I promise it is the final one, is education 50 years time. Yeah. Your vision. What if you could script it, what would your vision be?
Yeah, I'm glad it's quick fire. I bet you are as well, because you know I can talk. not knowledge based and focusing on realizing your passion and your potential.
Love that. It's been a long time coming, but really worth it. I've loved listening to the journey. I can see the passion that you have for what you're doing now, and the realization of you might go into something else differently. Who knows? But where you are now is probably the right place and where you should be, based on the passion that you're sharing for it. Hopefully, the listeners, when it comes out, really enjoy this one, and please let us know. It might bring some Googlers to listen. Who knows, Liz, through your connections and your everything else.
The PR team, right?
Yeah, who knows? Who knows?
Oh my God.
Yeah, that didn't sound scripted. That didn't sound scripted. But yeah, no. It's been
Is that what you're worried about?
I hope so. Yeah, because I still have to work with them, Liz. Do
you know I know. Yeah. Well, actually, a lot of them are my friends. So,
I've not criticised anybody. I've just criticised the whole beast rather than the individuals that work in it.
So, I'm glad it's turned out that you did that. That's perfect.
Did I? Oh, my God.
Yeah, you did, Steve.
I think you might have been Liz there.
There's a football song that generally gets sung to managers that are struggling. You're getting sacked in the morning. You're getting sacked in the morning. It's ringing in my ears right now. So who knows?
Well, it won't be tomorrow morning because it's not going out for me.
I'll enjoy Bet. But it will be. It will be there. But no, Liz, it's been an absolute pleasure. Brilliant to have you on. A real blast. And thanks for sharing the journey and everything that you're doing.
Appreciate it.
Thanks, Liz.
Really good fun. Take care.
Thank you.
Cheers. Yeah, see ya.
Bye.